It's Tuned to Yesterday, delivering shows from the golden age of radio. Welcome. I'm your host, Mark Levenier. Coming up in this hour, Dramatic Fair from the You Are There series, where the CBS News Unit imagines reporting on events of the past. Right now, it's light drama from Rogers of the Gazette, starring Parley Bear, Georgia Ellis, and Will Rogers Jr. This episode, a holiday-themed show from December 23, 1953, on CBS.
Ladies and gentlemen, the editor of the Elyria Weekly Gazette, Mr. Will Rogers, Jr.
Thank you. Remember the harsh old axioms that used to apply to children? I remember one my grandmother used a lot. Children should be seen and not heard. Of course, no one figures it that way anymore. Sometimes, for instance, I don't think they should even be seen.
Rogers of the Gazette, offering you again transcribed another heartwarming story of a country newspaper and its friendly editor, and starring Will Rogers, Jr.
I'm Doc Clemens, a friend of Will's. And the reason that Will's taking a slightly dim view of children this week is pretty much my fault. About every 6 months or so, my daughter Marjorie and her husband, who live in the city, like to take off for a little holiday, so they send Mike up to me for a few days. Now, don't misunderstand me. Mike's as good a grandson as ever came along, and I love him. But either I've forgotten how it was to be 12 years old, or the 12-year-old of today is a special new breed of youngster. Last Monday, when Will and I met him at the train, it couldn't have been just last Monday. But by golly, it was. Well, in that case, regardless of what the calendar says, this was the longest week of the year.
You sure you told him to meet you up here by the station, Doc?
I thought that'd be the safest, but I sure don't see him around here anyplace.
Marjorie didn't mention anything special he'd be wearing, so you'd know him.
Will, Mike's my own grandson. I guess I'd recognize my own grandson. Tisn't as if we're total strangers, you know. I saw him not 3 months ago in the city.
Well, kid's got a way of shooting up, you know. Seems like Jill changes right before my eyes sometimes.
Well, doggone it, I'd hate to think I wouldn't know my own kin if they walked right up to
me. All right, now, just try and hold your temper. Kids don't like to visit grandparents when they're old grouches.
I'm not an old grouch. I just flatly deny I wouldn't know Mike if I saw him.
Now, wait a minute. Isn't that Mike coming this way?
Where?
Right over there by the baggage truck. He just broke into a run.
Oh, for heaven's sake, that's not Mike. Why, that youngster's a good head taller than Mike. Besides, Marjorie'd never get him into a dark blue suit.
Well, this kid's in a hurry about something.
The idea of thinking he's Mike. Why, he doesn't resemble him in the slightest.
Hi, Grandpa.
Huh?
Don't you remember me? I'm Mike.
Well, as if I didn't know. Well, it's good to see you, boy. Good to see you.
Ouch.
What's the matter, to hurt you?
It's my arm. It sort of hurts.
Well, we'll have to tend to that later. Let me get a good look at you, Mike. Yes, sir, you haven't changed a bit. I'd know you anywhere.
I didn't think you remembered me.
Oh, no, that's just plain silly. Why wouldn't your old grandpa remember his only grandson?
You sure didn't act like
Fish
it.
Posh. Well, I was just saying to Will... Oh, you remember Mr. Rogers, don't you, Mike?
Oh, sort of. Hello.
Hello, Mike.
Shake hands with him, son.
Oh, sure. Ouch!
Oh, I'm sorry, Mike. I forgot about your arm.
What happened to it, son? If it bothers you that much, we'd better get home and have a look at it.
Oh, it isn't anything much. We almost had a wreck on the train.
You what?
Yeah, we had to stop real quick so we wouldn't hit a bus full of school kids. I got thrown to the floor. The train stopped so quick.
You didn't hit the bus then?
No, sir, but man, was it close. Boy, we just missed him.
Let me feel your forehead, Mike.
Oh, I'm all right.
Mm-hmm. Well, it won't do any harm to get on home and just let your old granddad look you over.
I'll get his bag, Doc.
Yeah, thanks, Will.
Gee, I sure hope that old lady's all right.
Old lady?
The one on the train. See, when we stopped so quick and all, she fell forward pretty hard. And gee, there was so much excitement and all that, well, I helped her back into her seat and got her some water. But she looked pretty bad. I sure hope she's all right.
Well, I hope so too, son, and I'm just real proud of you for helping her that way.
Golly, that wasn't anything.
Well, your mother will be mighty proud of you, too, Mike. Yes, sir. You and I are going to have ourselves the time of our lives this week. Just the time of our lives.
Where'd they go today, Will?
Hunting again, Maggie. That's 3 days in a row. I haven't talked to Doc, but Hazel Burroughs lives next door, you know, and she says they streak out before dawn every blessed day.
I take it Mike's arm wasn't hurt too bad then.
Oh, Doc did call me about that when they got home from the station Monday. Said it was just bruised a little.
Well, it's a wonderful thing for Doc to have that boy around.
Mm-hmm. Isn't going to hurt Mike any either. You know, city boys need a crack at country living every once in a while. I remember my old grandpop taught me a lot about hunting and fishing and the outdoors. Did me a lot of good.
Yeah. Grandmother taught me a lot of things, too, about hunting and trapping, the right bait to use. Only grandmother was an indoor sport. A lot of good it did me.
Where is a chair? Or preferably a feather bed.
What's the matter, Doc?
You look all done in.
You are looking at what's left of the oldest man in the world. Father Time is my youngest child.
Great to be a boy again, isn't it?
Oh, it's murder. I've discovered why you're only young once. Nobody could go through it a second time. I ache from stem to stern. Especially stern.
What sort of shape is Mike in?
Fresh as a daisy, I regret to say.
Well, he'll be learning a lot just the same.
I'm learning a lot. I show him all the fine points of a gun, spend ever so much time training him to sight, showing him the advantage of just squeezing the trigger, anticipating the flight of the game.
All good stuff to learn.
Uh-huh. When the time comes, he grabs a gun, does everything wrong, and he's shot the limit every day.
Doc, that isn't fair.
I plod along full of technique and fine points and haven't hit a thing.
Well, you can always get back to medicine, Doc.
Presuming, of course, that I have the strength. I am a very old man.
But you are having fun, aren't you, Doc? I mean, just the two of you being together is something.
Yeah, of course it is, Maggie. I'm having a wonderful time. But to tell you the truth, I think Mike's getting a little bored. That's why I stopped by. I thought you two might have a bright idea between you.
What's he doing now?
Exploring. He spotted the old Thackeray place, wanted to know why it was so ramshackled, and when I told him no one had lived there for 20 years or so, he said he'd like to look around a while. Oh, look at the time. I'm going to pick him up in a few minutes. Then I've got an afternoon of calls to make. Of course, I guess he could do his writing.
If he's a writer, maybe we can put him to work.
Yeah, oh, he's a writer, all right. Says it's a diary. He puts down every single thing he does.
Well, we ought to be able to find something better for Mike to do than poke around in an old empty house. Hey, I know. I know just the spot for him.
I'm almost afraid to ask.
The fire station.
Hey, oh, no. I wouldn't want to impose on Emory.
Oh, you can't impose on Emory Locke. No one likes to talk more than he does, and he's proud as can be of that station and the new fire truck. Unless you don't think Mike would enjoy that.
Oh, no, he'd love it.
Well, then why don't you let me go over to the old Thackeray place and pick him up? I'll see he's occupied at the fire station this afternoon. Then you can pick him up at my house at supper time.
Oh, sounds fine. If you're sure it wouldn't be too much trouble for you.
Yeah, no trouble at all.
I'd sure be much obliged.
And so would Will, Doc. He's been looking for a chance to play fireman ever since Emory got the new truck.
Some truck, Mike?
Yeah, it's real big. Well, what do you call all those ladders on it?
Ladders?
Oh. When are you going to have a fire, Mr. Locke?
Well, now I hope we never have another one, Mike. It's been 21 days since the last one, hasn't it, Will?
3 weeks today.
I'm only going to be here a couple more days.
Well, I wouldn't want to promise you a fire before you leave. Fires are awful things, Mike. Destructive. Sometimes they're killers. Much as I admire this new truck here, I'd like it if we never had to drive it out of the station.
Where are the firemen?
Mr. Locke here is our only regular fireman, Mike. The rest of the men are volunteers.
Yeah, but where are they?
All at their places of business, son. Sam down at the barber shop, John at Mr. Rogers' paper, and then some of them work in the hardware store at the ice house. We got them all over.
What does that mean?
That means it's 12 o'clock noon, Mike.
I thought maybe that was a fire signal.
Matter of fact, it is, when it blows more than once. Come on over here. I'll show you what I mean. Now, the whistle you just heard is way up there, top of the fire station, see?
Oh, yeah, I guess so.
Now, at noon and at 5 in the evening, It blows just once. Lots of folks set their clocks by it, because that's automatic. It goes off by itself at those times.
Now, in case of a fire, that's different. Being the fire chief, Emery here gets the call. Then he
Tell the boy about it, Will. Being the fire chief and all.
Oh, yeah. Sure, Emery. Go right ahead.
I get the call, Mike. The report of the fire. As soon as I know where it is, I sound the fire whistle by hand.
Well, if it's the same whistle, why don't folks just think it's noon or 5 o'clock? How do they know it's a fire?
I'm coming to that, boy.
Now, you see the map up there, Mike, pasted against the wall?
Sure, I see it.
Well, now, that's a map of Elyria, see? And what... You want to explain the map to him, Emery?
If I get the chance, I will.
Go right ahead.
Now, you see that map up there, boy? That's a map of Elyria. It's divided into 4 sections. Now, suppose the fire's in this north section of town.
The one marked 2?
That's right. Now, if it's in that section, I give 2 blasts on the fire signal. If it's in the south of town, that's 3 blasts of the whistle. The east side, 4 blasts, and 5 blasts if it's over here in the west. You understand, son?
Boy, I'll bet those 5-blast fires are exciting.
Last fire we had was a 5-blaster, boy.
Yeah, I sure would have liked to have heard that.
I got the call from 4 or 5 panicky neighbors. I sounded the 5 blasts, and the volunteers come running. We powered right over to West Elm and put it out in no time.
West Elm? We're on West Elm.
No need to go into that, Emily.
Will you stop interrupting me, Will? Let's see now, boy. I got a pin there where it was. Let's see.
Grandpa lives in the 5th block.
Pull the pin out here and see.
Now, Emery.
Yeah, here it is. Some hophead was burning leaves, and they got away from him. 527.
That's Grandpa.
What?
Grandpa, Doc Clemens. He's the hophead you were talking about.
Oh. Oh, yes. Yeah, I forgot for a moment who you belong to, boy. Will, darn you, next time you try to interrupt me, will you?
I just barely get him away from there for meals and sleeping purposes, Will. That boy lives with Emery at the fire station.
Well, you don't have to worry about where he is. That's one thing.
Of course, I understand you have a small worry with him.
You mean Jill?
Mm-hmm.
She's crazy about him. She's already put him on her God bless list every night when she says her prayers. And if I'm not mistaken, he moves up a notch on the list every night.
Well, his intentions are honorable, I'm proud to say. He told me he plans to marry her when she grows up. Seems to feel he's of age right now.
They're already playing house, you know.
Yeah.
Mrs. Weatherwax tells me all the kids in the neighborhoods are using the old Thackeray place for a clubhouse after school.
Yeah, I've heard about it. Well, at least they picked a spot near home Mrs. Weatherwax can keep an eye on.
Just hope none of them get hurt running through that old house. A good wind would blow it down, you know.
Well, if they weren't doing that, they'd be falling out of trees or something. When they've got that kind of energy, they're just bound to let it loose on something. I've near had apoplexy a couple of times watching Mike slide down that pole at the fire station or shinny up one of the ladders or some fool thing. Hey, that's a fire, Will.
Shh. 3. 4. 5. That's the west side, Doc.
Call Emery, Will.
Number, please.
Give me the fire station, Harriet.
Oh, all right, Will.
And tell Emery for me not to let that boy go to the fire.
Fire station.
It's Will, Emery. Where's the fire?
It's old Thackeray place, Will. I can't talk now. The boys are piling in here. It'll go up in no time. That old house is nothing but a tinderbox. More water over to the side there, Sam. Keep back, you people. Keep clear back on the street. There's nothing to see. Now keep back.
Will? Will?
Maggie, what did Mrs. Weatherwax say?
It's all right. Jill's not home from school yet.
Oh, thank heaven.
Did Doc find Mike?
Yeah. He got here with a fire truck, all right. Only Doc was waiting for him. He pulled him right off.
Well, I don't see him around.
Oh, they're over here somewhere. I don't think Doc could pry Mike out of here.
It's awful. It's just awful.
Now they've got it under control, Maggie. Just be thankful it was an empty house and that the fire didn't spread.
Oh, golly, Grandpa, just because I wanted to help with the hose.
Never you mind about that. John was doing just fine with the hose. Fires aren't for little boys.
Oh, golly.
Now, you just simmer down.
You got to ride over in the truck, didn't you, Mike? That must have been pretty exciting.
Sure it was. Boy, we got here in no time.
I told you that was some truck, Mike.
Yeah, I rode right next to the chief, too. And I stood right by him when he sounded that five blaster. Boy, wait till I tell Jill about that.
You better be getting ready for bed, hadn't you, Jill?
I guess so, Daddy.
What's the matter, honey? You got awful quiet after Doc and Mike left this evening.
Oh, nothing. I was just thinking.
Well, you better do your thinking in bed, honey. Run in and say goodnight to Mrs. Weatherwax. I'll be up in a little while and tuck you in.
Couldn't I just think in here with you for a little while?
It's bedtime.
I know, but... Oh, all right, Daddy.
You sure nothing's wrong, Jill? You're not sick?
Oh, no, nothing like that.
Something go wrong at school?
No, I'll go tell Mrs. Weatherwax goodnight.
All right. I'll be up in a little while.
Will it be in the Gazette about the fire?
Mm-hmm. I guess so.
What will it say?
Well, just the old Thackeray place burned down. I'll talk to Emery Locke in the morning. He'll tell me all about it. Why, Jill?
Well, I just wondered.
Hey, I'll bet that's what's bothering you. You and Mike and the rest of your gang won't have a clubhouse now, will you?
I guess not.
Well, don't worry about that, honey. Maybe we can find you a better one. That wasn't much of a place to play anyway.
Mike said it was haunted.
You didn't believe that, did you?
I don't know. Mike said it was.
Well, you and I don't believe in haunted houses. Whether Mike says so or not, do we?
No, not really. There aren't any such things as ghosts, I don't think. Except in ghost stories.
That's right. Mike was just kidding you a little. You're going to miss him when he goes tomorrow, aren't you?
No, not anymore.
What? Well, I thought he was something special around here.
I used to like him, but... Daddy.
Hey, what's wrong, honey? Why, you're shaking all over.
Don't make me say my prayers tonight, Daddy. Please don't make me. I couldn't. I just couldn't say them tonight.
Oh, we always say our prayers, Jill. Especially when we're all upset like you are. Can't you tell me about it?
I couldn't ask God to bless Mike tonight. Not tonight. I couldn't ask him to. Don't make me do it.
Why not tonight, honey?
Not after what he did. Oh, Daddy, I don't know what to do. Mike's a bad boy. I don't like him anymore. And I'm not going to say his name in my prayers anymore.
Now. Mike's not such a bad boy, Jill. What makes you think he is?
Daddy, Mike set fire to the old Thackeray house.
Jill!
He did. He told me so after dinner tonight. And that makes him a bad boy. And I don't like him anymore.
Well, morning, Will. You're out early, aren't you?
Yeah, a little, Doc. Mind if I come in?
Yeah, come on in. Have a cup of coffee with me. Come on back to the kitchen.
Mike still asleep?
I don't think he slept a wink all night. Couldn't get that fire off his mind. Then he bolted out of here about half an hour ago. Couldn't wait for me to drive him to the fire station. Here, sit down.
Thanks. Never mind about the coffee for me. I've had 3 cups already.
Well, I don't need this one myself. I think that fire's got us all a little edgy.
Did Mike talk a lot about it, Doc?
Talk about it? I can give you every step of the trip. From the incoming call, through the whistle blast, to who got to the station first.
No. I mean the fire itself.
No. Except for ragging me about not letting him work the hose with John.
Why? Do you think he wrote anything down about it in that diary he keeps?
I'm sure he did. Hey, why all the questions? Well, what are you leading up to?
Now, Doc, understand she's just a kid. She's had a tough time telling me about it and all.
Now, Will, what
Doc,
on earth...
Doc, Mike told Jill he set fire to the Thackeray place.
Oh, you're kidding. No. You're not kidding, are you?
I'm not. I know Jill believes it with all her heart.
Well, I can't believe it, Will. He... Well, Mike wouldn't do a thing like that. That'd be... Well, he just wouldn't do it.
It's hard to believe, Doc. I don't want to believe it. Jill's half sick with believing it. The thing is, why would he tell her he set the fire if he didn't?
I don't know. Well, we'll have to find out. I'll talk to Mike. I'll go right down to the fire station now and have it out with
him. Well, whatever you think, Doc. I just couldn't set on it. I didn't want to talk to Emery without talking to you first.
No. No, you did the right thing, all right. Come to me.
See, Emery'd know if the fire had been set deliberately.
Oh, sure, of course he would. I wonder if maybe we ought to talk to Emery first.
Might be a good idea. Only Mike's down at the station with him. Be kind of tough talking with him there.
Yeah, it would. I know. I'll take him over to Sam's. He needs a haircut. He's going home later today. That is, he was going home.
I'll meet you down there, Doc.
No, I don't think so, Will. I poked around the place for a long time after we put the fire out. Nothing to indicate it was set deliberately.
Well, I hope you're right.
It's been dry, you know. No moisture in weeks. Like I told you yesterday, that place was a tinderbox. Dry as punk.
You mean it wouldn't take much to start a fire like that?
Not much. A cigarette tossed from a passing car, a couple of sparks from a chimney. That's all it'd take. You saw yourself how fast it burned.
Mm-hmm. Then it couldn't have been started earlier in the day or even the night before. It wouldn't have smoldered for a while and then gone through the whole place.
Too dry. Nothing there to smolder. Nope, from the first spark, whatever it was, to the last burst of flame was a matter of minutes, believe me.
And Mike was with you all the time yesterday, right up to when the call came.
That boy hasn't left my side in days. Nope, I'm sure as anything that this is just another one of his fairy tales.
Another one?
Sure. He's full of them. Goes from one to the other, without taking time for breath, mostly.
Hey, there's not a word of truth in it, is there, Emery, about Mike and the fire?
Not a syllable, Doc.
Did you talk to him?
I didn't have to. This letter came to me special right after you left, Will. It's from my daughter, Marjorie. Remember that bruised arm Mike had when he got here and that story of how the train had to stop quick for a school bus?
Oh, yeah. Pitched Mike right on the floor of the train.
Hooey. Says right here in Marjorie's letter he fell off his skates the morning before he came here. Bruised his arm.
What?
Yeah, I just stopped at the depot. Homer Ward was the brakeman on Mike's train coming up from the city. No school bus, no sudden stop.
That's what I mean, Will. Fairy tales. Mike's just full of them.
Yeah, and this business about the fire. I decided to look in his diary, which I wouldn't do except in extreme circumstances, you understand, but there it was. And I quote, "Should have seen Jill's eyes when I told her I set the fire. I'm sorry I made it all up, but you should have seen her eyes."
Well, I'll be darned. Well, no one will be happier than Jill when I tell her the truth.
I couldn't believe he'd set the fire, but this business is hard to believe, too. Because he likes Jill, he must have thought telling her that it'd make him seem important somehow.
I don't understand it. Mike's a good boy, he really is. He doesn't mean to lie, I'm sure of that. I think he just gets carried away, like in make-believe, you know.
Well, he needs to learn a lesson. Make-believe's all right up to a point, but this thing about the fire is serious, real serious. Maybe we ought to give him a little of the fright he gave Jill and the rest of it.
Yeah, if you don't put a stop to it now, with his imagination, he might grow up to be a writer or even an actor.
Oh, no, please, not that. All right now, Mike, you don't have to cry anymore. Your train's due any time now.
He scared me. Mr. Locke, he scared me something awful.
Emery was just doing what we all thought was best for you, son. If you go around admitting to things you didn't do, you shouldn't be surprised when someone accuses you of it.
But he knows now, doesn't he, Grandpa? I wouldn't set a fire, not really.
We all know, Mike. The important thing is, have you learned a lesson? The difference between truth and make-believe.
Yes, sir. I think so. I should always tell the truth. But Make-believe's all right if it doesn't hurt anyone.
And if everyone knows it's make-believe.
Yes, sir. I guess Jill doesn't like me anymore, does she, Grandpa?
You want her to like you, son?
I'll say. That's all I ever wanted, for Jill to like me.
Yeah, she's a pretty fine girl. I know her daddy had a talk with her about you and me. Well, look who's coming.
I wasn't sure we'd make it in time.
You just made it, Will.
Hello, Jill.
Hello, Mike.
Well, go on, honey. You had something to say to Mike, remember?
I forgive you, Mike, and, well, Mrs. Weatherwax made you these cookies.
Gee, thanks.
Better hurry up, son. You've got to get on that train.
Yeah, well, thanks for the cookies, and maybe I'll see you again sometime. Well, goodbye, Grandpa.
Right.
Mr. Rogers. Goodbye, Jill.
Goodbye, Mike.
Goodbye, Mike.
Here's something I thought you ought to have.
Oh, golly. My own fire truck. Oh, golly, thanks. Thanks for everything.
Goodbye, son. Bye. Remember now about make-believe.
Yes, sir. Oh, excuse me, ma'am. Is this seat taken?
Oh, no, indeed, young man. Sit right down.
Thank you. Bye. Bye.
That's your family out there waving to you?
Those two men and the girl?
Mm-hmm.
Well, what makes you think that? Do they look like my family?
Well, no. No, not especially. You don't favor either one of the men.
Maybe not, but I sure favor Jill.
Oh, then Jill's a relative.
Oh, heck no. She's no relative. She's my wife.
You have just heard Rogers of the Gazette, starring Mr. Will Rogers, Jr., with Parley Bear as Doc Clemens and Georgia Ellis as Maggie Button.
Rogers of the Gazette, on Tuned to Yesterday, a CBS broadcast from December 23, 1953. This is an hour of drama on Tuned to Yesterday. I'm your host, Mark Levillier. That last episode we heard was from the Columbia Broadcasting System, and the CBS Radio Network, which was named that in 1929, grew to be a fierce competitor in radio broadcasting and quickly gained a reputation for its news gatherers, reporters, and commentators like H.V. Kaltenborn, Bob Trout, and Edward R. Murrow. And up until 1947, rare was the instance where the CBS News unit was combined with entertainment in any form. That is, until the idea was created by radio writer Goodman Ace of a show that would bring the CBS newsroom and their dramatic talent together in a program called You Are There. In this unique storytelling model, members of the CBS News would seemingly be at historical events around the globe and report on them as if there were no modern technology used except for news reporting and transmitting. From July of 1947 to March of 1950, certified CBS radio newsmen John Daly and Don Hollenbeck would present what was made to sound like actual news coverage of events like the fall of Troy, the first exploration of the Grand Canyon, the hanging of Captain Kidd, and in this next broadcast, the events of June 25, 1788, the day the U.S. Constitution was ratified. From September 19, 1948, Ned Kalmer, Ken Roberts, and Carl Swenson also in this broadcast of You Are There.
You are there.
Virginia, key state in the plan to form the 13 original states into a united America, stands undecided, torn by dissension, and the Constitution hangs in the balance. CBS takes you back to the day that determined whether Americans could go forward from revolution and establish a stable central government. All things are as they were then, except for one thing. When CBS is there,
You Are There.
You Are There is based on authentic historical fact and quotation. And now,
Virginia, the Richmond Convention Hall, and John Daly.
For a group of reporters hurriedly summoned to the governor's executive chamber a few minutes ago, asked why he is turning from the party of Patrick Henry to the party of James Madison, Governor Randolph would not amplify his statement, saying only that he will give the reasons which prompted his move on the floor of the convention. And we hurried from that news conference to this microphone here on the convention floor to bring you this news. There's Mr. James Monroe, one of Mr. Patrick Henry's chief lieutenants, in the fight against ratification. Mr. Monroe.
Sir?
Sir, are you aware that Governor Randolph has gone over to the Federalist Party?
I am indeed.
Would you care to comment on it, Mr. Monroe?
Any remarks on Governor Randolph's strange conduct will come from Mr. Henry, the leader of our party.
But how do you think Governor Randolph's action will affect the vote on ratification, sir?
No comment, sir. No comment.
Mr. Monroe has turned away from the microphone. Our brief conversation, a mark of the confusion Governor Randolph's change of mind has produced here. Ned Kelmer has been analyzing the possibilities inherent in Governor Randolph's action and is ready now with his report. So over to our CBS headquarters booth here in Convention Hall and Ned Kelmer.
Governor Randolph's sudden allegiance to the Federalists may have a decisive effect on this convention. Roughly half of the delegates represent the cities, towns, and the Tidewater planters, and the other half come from the rural districts. Generally speaking, the planters and the businessmen are in favor of a national constitution. They are haunted by memories of Daniel Shea's rebellion in Massachusetts last year, and they want the constitution as an instrument to end social chaos. Just a moment, Governor Randolph, at his executive mansion, has consented to grant our reporter Don Hollenbeck a brief interview before departing for this convention hall. So over to Don Hollenbeck at the governor's mansion.
Governor Randolph, sir, will you tell us why you've made this last-minute turn from the Anti-Constitution Party to the Federalists?
I have joined the Federalists because the Anti-Constitution Party has caused too much, far too much delay on the pressing issue of a strong central government.
Why do you feel that we need a strong central government such as the proposed constitution outlines?
It is imperative. The union of the states sags apart for want of it. Mr. Henry fails to see the danger. He occupies himself with legalistic assaults on various phases of the constitution without realizing that the measure as a whole is desperately needed.
Well, Governor, do you endorse the proposed constitution in toto without amendments?
No, I do not. I hope and trust that certain amendments will subsequently be adopted, such as a Bill of Rights and a clause absolutely forbidding the importation of Negro slaves. But all that can come later. Time is running out, and we cannot go on under the Articles of Confederation.
Thank you, Governor Randolph. This is Don Hollenbeck returning you now to John Daly on the floor of Convention Hall.
About 80 delegates are here now, and among them is Mr. Patrick Henry, former governor of Virginia, leader of the Anti-Constitution Party. He's wearing the ill-fitting wig and shabby black coat for which he is famous, and his hawk-like face is grim and forbidding. Mr. Henry! Sir, would you care to comment on Governor Randolph's repudiation of the Anti-Constitution Party?
Governor Randolph, bah! My opponents are welcome to him. He, like they, has turned his back on the revolution. He's divorced himself from the common people and embraced that hydra-headed monster property.
Well, do you mean to suggest, sir, that the Constitution favors the property-holding classes of the nation?
Suggest? Nay, I charge it. The worship of private property is implicit in every article of that infamous document. 1 year ago, sir, at Philadelphia, the Constitution stank so noisomely that Governor Randolph refused to sign it. Does it smell any sweeter now? No. The Constitution remains unchanged. It is Edmund Randolph who has changed. Randolph. An empty sail billowing with the wind from the Tidewater.
Are you implying, Mr. Henry, that Governor Randolph has yielded to pressure from the Tidewater plantation
owners? No, no. Randolph was born with a golden spoon in his mouth. He is rich. He has many slaves. He is also a politician, and as such, he flirted briefly with the ideas of liberty and equality. But the governor has seen the light. Property is the thing that counts.
Well, wouldn't you say, sir, that the protection of private property is important for the welfare of the country?
Important, yes. But human rights are equally important. And where, I ask you, where do you find one single mention of human rights in this Constitution that we are asked to ratify today?
But if that is so, Mr. Henry, how do you explain that 8 states have already ratified the Constitution?
The citizens of those 8 states would bargain away their heritage of freedom for a mess of pottage. For my part, give me liberty, greatest of all earthly blessings. Give me that precious jewel, and you may take everything else.
Thank you, Mr. Henry. Here comes Mr. Madison. He's a small man and quiet of voice, but Mr. Madison yields to no man in intellectual capacity. Indeed, he is as famous for the logic of his arguments as Mr. Patrick Henry is for the brilliance of his oratory. Mr. Madison! Mr. Madison, Mr. Henry has just charged that the Constitution places property rights above human rights.
An interesting phrase, but then Patrick Henry is a master of interesting phrases. One of them helped to start our revolution. The trouble is, Mr. Henry is in a constant state of revolution. He should remember that the war is over and that his antagonists in this hall are not redcoats.
Yes, Mr. Madison, but what about his argument, sir?
Ah, yes. Property rights above human rights. Well, now, suppose we examine that without the benefit of oratory, shall we? Mr. Henry would give you the impression that this is a struggle between the rich and the poor, the strong and the weak. The fact is, sir, that there are wealthy men who hate the Constitution and poor men who love it. The point is that all Americans, rich and poor, are in dire straits today because we have no strong central government. Mr. Henry poses as the shining knight of liberty. But where, sir, is liberty without order? Order is what we need, not at the expense of human rights, but precisely to render them secure.
Well, Mr. Madison, it's been reported that Mr. Thomas Jefferson, our ambassador to France, is against the Constitution.
That, sir, is a distortion. Mr. Jefferson is a friend of mine. I'm in constant correspondence with him. It is true that he disagrees with some aspects of the Constitution, but on the whole, he favors it. As a matter of fact, it would be well for Mr. Henry to remember there are other patriots of the War for Independence who stand behind the Constitution. Not only Thomas Jefferson, but General Washington, Benjamin Franklin, Alexander Hamilton, John Dickinson, and a host of others.
Thank you, Mr. Madison.
A pleasure, sir.
Well, you've heard that the Constitution would be of great benefit to all Americans, and you've also heard that it will benefit only the rich. Outside this Virginia Hall, there's a representative crowd waiting for the result of the vote, and Ken Roberts is out there. So let's switch to him and find out how these people feel about the Constitution. Go ahead, Ken Roberts.
In this crowd, judging by their dress, are people from every section and class of Virginia. I see men who are obviously planters, others who must be tradesmen, and a large number of farming folk. Some of them must have come a long way to be in Richmond at this fateful hour. Here, for instance, is a tall man wearing a fringed shirt and a coonskin cap. Where are you from, sir?
I be from Pineville, in the Western District.
You're a delegate, sir?
Nay, I come here to watch over the delegates. I want to be sure they vote the way they're supposed to.
And how are the delegates of the Western District supposed to vote, Mr.?
Holloway, Thomas Holloway, and they're still supposed to vote against the Constitution when Governor Randolph will be paying for turning his court on us come next election.
Would you mind telling us why you're against the Constitution, Mr. Holloway?
See this bullet wound in my left arm? I received it 10 years ago, come September. I received it fighting to free Virginia from the rule of King George.
Don't you mean that you were fighting to free the United States?
Nay, to free Virginia.
But aren't you a citizen of the United States?
Nay, I'm a citizen of Virginia. We fought to be rid of the third George, and we want no fourth to take his place.
Then you think the Constitution would result in a king being imposed on the American states?
Aye.
What makes you think so?
If there be a Constitution, there'll be a president. If there be a president, he'll waste no time making himself into a monarch.
But, Mr. Holloway, it's generally agreed that if the Constitution is ratified, the first president of the United States will be General George Washington.
Aye. He'll waste no time making himself into a monarch.
Ridiculous.
You think that General Washington, if elected, will establish a monarchy?
Aye. There'll be nothing in the Constitution to stop him if he's a mind to. And I reckon he'll have a mind to. Power would be spoiling a man, say I. There's always
that. That's a ridiculous statement. It's evil, and it's
Mr. Holloway has just been interrupted by a well-dressed man in the crowd.
Trapped in a jail for talking that way about General Washington.
Would you have a mind to make for an enemy, fine boy?
You're besmirching the reputation of the best man in the world.
Just a moment, please. Gentlemen, just a moment. Sir, we'll be glad to have your opinions on General Washington and the Constitution after Mr. Holloway has finished.
For himself, I have no.
Now, Mr. Holloway, you were just saying
aye.
General Washington will make himself king if the Constitution is ratified.
Aye, and he could do it. According to the Constitution, the president would have his own standing army.
Yes, but wouldn't the army be subject to the decisions of the federal Congress?
With a gun at its throat, what could the Congress do? He'll be making himself monarch
Congress or no.
Thank you, Mr. Holloway. Now, sir, now you have your opportunity.
He'll tell you now. She's an empty head, that.
Empty head? I would tell you, see, abuse, canards, that's the way with you rascals.
Rascals.
You impute the most dastardly motives to the patriots who frame the Constitution. You don't want the truth.
Don't want the truth.
You're riff-raff, troublemakers, that's all you are. The scum of the backwoods.
This is John Daly in Convention Hall. We have interrupted Ken Roberts because Governor Randolph has just come in. He entered by a side door to avoid the crowd outside. Now he is walking down the aisle, and the tension here is so thick one can literally feel. Mr. Henry has just snubbed Governor Randolph, and the snub was unmistakable. His face pale, the governor has walked to his seat, sits down, shakes hands with Mr. Madison. Now the gavel sounds. Mr. Pendleton, president of the convention, is calling the delegates to order. The final debate will begin in a few moments. As has already been debated clause by clause in the 3 weeks this convention has been in session. And now, Mr. Pendleton.
The Virginia ratifying convention is hereby declared to be officially convened. By previous agreement, the final speech in opposition to ratification will be made by Patrick Henry. And he will be followed by Mr. James Madison, who will speak in favor of ratification of the proposed federal constitution. I now recognize the first speaker, Mr. Henry.
And Patrick Henry rises, walking slowly up the aisle. He's moving toward the front of the hall. Now he's mounting the rostrum. His hawk-like eyes under that ragged wig look out piercingly around the room, and they have come to rest on Governor Randolph. Mr. Henry stares at the governor now with an expression of, well, you might almost call it contempt, and now Mr. Henry is about to speak.
My concluding remarks in behalf of the Anti-Constitution Party, the Party of Liberty, will be brief. But I would first make a few observations on the conduct of one of the delegates. I am referring to none other than Governor Edmund Randolph. Last year in Philadelphia, Governor Randolph denounced the Constitution. It seems to me very strange that that which was then the subject of his denunciations should today become the object of his praise. Something extraordinary must have happened to operate so great a change in his opinions.
Mr. President! Mr. President!
Governor Randolph is calling for the floor. He's been ruled out of order. Now, Mr. Henry.
I yield to the member. Let us hear what the honorable member has to say.
The honorable speaker hints that I have changed my opinions for some hidden and therefore discreditable reason.
I have no personal intention of offending anyone. I merely do my duty.
The gentleman smiles when he says that. His conduct is malicious, and it is not compatible with the least shadow of friendship. Very well. If our friendship must fall, let it fall like Lucifer, never to rise again.
Does the member accuse me of malicious behavior?
I believe the meaning of my words is clear.
Is the member prepared to back up his remarks with deeds?
If the gentleman seeks satisfaction, he will find my seconds ready.
I thank the gentleman for his willingness to render satisfaction. Mr. President, I request a short recess in order to arrange the details of a matter of honor.
This is unprecedented. However, due to... the member's request is granted. I hereby declare a 5-minute recess.
Mr. Randolph and Mr. Henry are leaving the hall, no doubt to choose and confer with their seconds, as is traditional in these affairs of honor among gentlemen. This is a startling turn of events, and we'll try and bring you the developments just as fast as we can. The floor here is a scene of confusion. The delegates are milling about, shouting and arguing, shaking their fists at each other, and from the look of things here, it would almost seem that there'll be more affairs of honor out there on the floor of this convention hall unless this convention is called back into order, and very soon. And there's Mr. Pendleton. Mr. Pendleton, sir, will the session resume in spite of this conflict between Mr. Henry and Mr. Randolph?
Yes, I will reconvene in 5 minutes.
And the vote will be taken as scheduled, sir?
Certainly.
Do you have anything to say on
that? Not now, please.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Pendleton. The debate will continue. The vote will be taken despite this dramatic interruption.
As you know, Mr. Henry is one of the principal speakers, and he must be back before the convention can properly be reconvened. As I said before, the floor is a scene of confusion, and there is a chance there'll be more of these affairs of honor unless the convention is indeed called back into session, and very soon. But now I've seen Ned Kelmer out there circulating quickly among the delegates to learn how Mr. Henry's attack on Governor Randolph will affect the vote. So let's go over to our CBS headquarters booth and Ned Kelmer.
Yes, thank you. Well, on the basis of my brief conversations with the delegates just now, it's safe to say that Mr. Henry, by his open attack on Mr. Randolph, has restored the situation to what it was before the governor came out in favor of the Constitution. Now Mr. Pendleton has called the convention to order again, so back to John Daly on the convention floor.
The Republic itself.
The delegates are again seated. The convention has reconvened, and Mr. Henry has resumed the floor and is speaking on the resolution embodying the proposed federal constitution of the United States of America. Now let's listen to Mr. Patrick Henry.
Exclusion of the four remaining states. Congress under this proposed constitution would have a tyrant's power and more. It could lay whatever taxes it chooses. With a standing army, it could keep the people in submission. The president, if he should be ruthless and able, could make himself an absolute ruler. I would rather have a king, lords, and a House of Commons than a government replete with such insupportable evils. Gentlemen, my opponents ask you to surrender not only the sword and the purse, but the very scales of justice. Ratify this Constitution, and you place our state courts at the mercy of federal courts. A monstrous creation. I dread popular resistance to this proposed government. So vague, so indefinite, so ambiguous in its assurances of liberty and human rights. Let me warn you in the most emphatic terms of the dreadful effects which must ensue should the people resist. I beg, I beseech the delegates to search their consciences and vote nay, nay on this resolution, lest they rouse the people to rebellion in defense of their God-given liberties.
Mr. Henry has left the rostrum, and Mr. Madison is coming up now to speak. He carries his hat in his hand. Now he's taking some slips of paper out of the hat. They are the notes for his address, and he's waiting for the convention to come to order.
Order. Chair recognizes Mr. James Madison.
Mr. President, fellow delegates, I yield to no man in my respect for the previous speaker. Yet in these brief concluding remarks, I would point out that his objections to the Constitution arise out of misunderstanding. This is not strange because the form of government we are proposing is new, unique in the history of the world. Let the delegates, therefore, not measure it by outmoded standards. Mr. President, the American states have stirred the admiration of the world by setting up free governments under the pressure of war. How much more will they win admiration if they should be able peaceably to establish one central government when not cemented by common danger? But will the states achieve that goal? Suppose only 8 states ratify and Virginia refuses to become the 9th, except on her own terms. Then even if the others agree to our terms, which is doubtful, every state must call new conventions to consider the amendments. There will be endless disagreements. Every state will be encouraged to offer its own amendments. Agreement will be even more difficult to reach than it was in Philadelphia. In short, Mr. President, if Virginia holds out today, the United States may never have a functioning central government. But if Virginia ratifies the Constitution, it may bring the most fortunate event in the history of mankind. I therefore respectfully submit that the honorable delegates vote yea on the resolution before us, the resolution containing the Constitution of the United States of America.
Mr. Madison replaces his notes in his hat and leaves the rostrum, and from the floor, many voices calling the question. Mr. Pendleton is raising his gavel.
The convention will now vote
On the resolution embodying the proposed Constitution for the United States of America. The vote will be by a show of hands. A simple majority will decide. Those delegates who are in favor, those who wish to vote aye on the proposition, will raise their right hand.
Hands are going up all over the hall, and the tellers are moving about counting. A total of 166 votes will be cast. 84 are necessary to carry or defeat the resolution. And it seems now as if half the number of delegates here have their hands up, but it's impossible to tell exactly. However, it's going to be close. You can be sure of that. Very close. We'll know the result in a moment from the eye count. If it's 84 or over, the eyes will have it, and the Constitution will be ratified here in the Virginia Convention and will become the law of the land. The tellers have completed their count now and are moving up to report to the rostrum. They're at the rostrum. Mr. Pendleton is receiving their reports, checking the totals, and we'll know in a moment. Mr. Pendleton.
The tellers report, in favor of the resolution, 89 votes.
The resolution carried by 89 votes, 5 votes more than necessary. The United States is now committed to a strong central government. We're to have a president, a Congress, a federal judiciary, a national army under the Constitution. I have a copy here in my hand, and its preamble begins, "We, the people of the United States, in order..."
June 25th, 1788, Virginia ratifies the Constitution and government of, by, and for the people begins.
Footnote. The Virginia Convention debated and voted under the impression that it was the ninth necessary ratifying state. The ninth necessary state was actually New Hampshire. It had ratified 4 days earlier. Mr. Madison, Mr. Henry, and their colleagues did not know this because in those days news traveled slowly.
CBS Radio's unique series, You Are There, from September 19th, 1948. And the curtain comes down on this hour of drama on Tuned to Yesterday. Be sure to be with us next time for more great programs from radio's golden era. Until our next hour together, I'm Mark Levonier. Thanks for tuning in.